Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. Peter Sage, really fantastic to see you.
Hey, Dan, what a pleasure to be here. Yes, and serendipitous how we connected, but I'm really pleased that we're able to make this happen.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this. I'm always excited for my podcast guests. They're always amazing, but particularly today, because Peter's got such an incredible CV where he's really achieved the highest of highs and perhaps gone to the lowest of lows, as many people would see it. He's an international serial entrepreneur, and he started selling toys at flea markets, I believe, as a 16-year-old.
Car boot sales in England, yeah.
Car boot sales in England. So he's a proper entrepreneur. And going forward, he was ended up sending or planning to send solar panels into space. So he's been sort of over a 30-year sort of entrepreneurial journey, really been there. He's a 6-times TEDx speaker with multiple number one best-selling books, one of which I'm reading, which is amazing, called The Inside Track. He's founded multiple 8-figure companies and raised over $1 million for various charities. And he gives away a lot of his knowledge on his YouTube channel and other platforms. And it's really good stuff, so you got to check it out. I believe he worked as a trainer alongside Tony Robbins for 15 years.
Yes. Yeah. Part of my journey into human behavior was really accentuated by, you know, being an experienced trainer and intervention specialist with Tony for, a decade and a half, traveling around the world with him at events, getting involved in some of the real, you know, sort of nitty gritty of working with participants to get them their outcomes.
Yeah. And this idea around kind of self-mastery is a theme through Peter's work. And I'm really interested in that. He's a fitness enthusiast. And from my point of view, really interesting. He ran the Marathon des Sables, which, if anybody doesn't know, is the world's toughest foot race, which I have signed up for and I'm doing in March 2022.
Wow. I didn't know that. Well done.
Yeah. Well, it was a big commitment because let's just say that was way out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
When I signed up this last year. So I'm going to maybe pick your brains for some tips on that.
Yeah, don't do it.
Brilliant.
Well, you're usually the biggest tip I give people. But yeah, we'll get to that.
I was going to shut this in at the end. There's a bit in your book, The Inside Track, where you're in Pentonville Prison, and you're saying the good thing is it's not as bad as the Marathon des Sables going sleeping arrangements. And I was like, hang on a minute.
Yeah, we will definitely cover some of that, I can promise.
So what's interesting is this podcast is all about my business blow up, which happened in 2017. And I managed to turn things around. So the point of this conversation is to help me still, because I'm still working from a place of humility here, and everybody listening, navigate some of these pitfalls in life. And what's interesting is around about the same time as I was having my kind of implosion, Peter was having a bit of a rough time. He'd gone from 2015, where he was named by Inspiring Leadership Now as one of the greatest leaders and entrepreneurs in the world, alongside Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Richard Branson. A couple of years later, was inside Pentonville Prison after being sent down for contempt of court. And you can expand on that, and I appreciate it. There's a bit of a story around that. But I'm just curious, how does a guy that's being name-checked alongside Elon Musk end up locked up in a London prison?
Great question. Didn't see it coming, I'll give you that. It's just to put some context to it. I mean, this was, as you say, a contempt of court. This was a civil action. I was not only inside Pentonville, I was the only non-criminal inside Pentonville. Wow. I've never been arrested. I've never been accused of a crime. I've never been charged with a crime. I've never been found guilty. I still don't have a criminal record, but I did 6 months in the most violent prison statistically in the UK. And that was on a civil action. It's really important for entrepreneurs to understand that when it comes to civil action, litigation is a tool. It's got nothing to do with who's right or wrong. Any entrepreneur that's been down that road will tell you 1,000%. Yeah, and I was actually fighting a civil action against a multi-billion dollar company who will probably remain nameless as Hewlett Packard. And when it comes to, we'd done about multi-million dollars worth of business back in the day. I was living in Dubai. I was buying and selling some IT equipment on the side to fund my space project. And I think I bought $12.5 million worth of goods, paid for it in full, resold it, small margin. And 7 years later, they knock at my home door in England, suing me for $17 million. And I'm like, what? They're like, yeah, we didn't give you permission to resell it. I'm like, you didn't give me a contract saying I couldn't. Says, yeah, but, and they were upset because some of the people I sold it to were authorized distributors that were buying cheaper from me than them. And that was the basis to it. And they wanted to teach me a lesson. They said, look, we're suing you for the difference between the wholesale and retail price. I'm like, that's crazy. Wow. No judge in his right mind, you know, look at that for 10 minutes. I says, yeah, we know that, but give us $100,000. We'll make it all go away. I'm like, oh, I get it. Yeah, you're just trying to put pressure on me because you want some of the profit that I made because you're jealous over. Yeah, I'm like, not playing. I'm too long in the tooth to get bullied. Right. Anyway, I should have listened to, instead of my ego, sort of pushing forward and kicking back. My contempt for what they were doing landed me in contempt of court. They issued a contempt of court application saying I breached a freezing order. I denied. I'm like, I haven't breached a freezing order. I looked at their argument. It was clever. It was, you'd expect that with Mish Conda Rea, one of the most ruthless law firms in London, $100 million firm. I'm on legal aid because they froze my accounts. You know, talk about really? David and Goliath. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And my barrister, I think, qualified from the legal school of mutism. Yeah. It's a.
Because I saw something about this. Like, so your representation, your barrister in court, didn't say, you didn't give your arguments?
None. We rehearsed, I practiced, we did everything. And if you'd have given 10% of what the actual facts were, it would have been thrown out, in my opinion. But again, it's courts about not who's right or wrong, it's who tells the best story, who hires the best storytellers. And they were good chess players. Mm. And my contempt for them landed me in contempt of court. So I'm like, this is just, I kick back. Anyway, long story short, I had to go there. Yeah, what I learned from the experience, not only from, again, some level of humility, but on what an opportunity to demonstrate what I've been teaching other people for many, many years to practice on myself, which is, you know, as you saw in the first part of the book, theory doesn't cover the price of admission to the higher levels of greatness. If you're a relationship coach, expect to have a relationship problem so you can prove to the world that you walk your talk. If you're a health coach, expect a health challenge. If you're a business coach, yeah, if you're a business entrepreneur, as an example for others, expect to have the challenges you need to demonstrate the level of entrepreneurship that'll allow you to give advice, not opinion. And that's really part of the journey we're on. So yeah, I ended up losing everything. I lost we're doing multiple six figures a month. Yeah, I went from 50 staff to 3 staff in 3 minutes. I lost everything. I got hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal debt. I mean, they spent $250,000 just on the committal. I mean, it was unbelievable. Mega budget. You know, I got nothing. Lost my wedding. I mean, just it was every rug you could pull from under me got pulled. And yeah, I found myself locked behind bars for 6 months as a non-criminal, unsegregated, in most violent prison in England. Again, I think 3 deaths in 1 week was the worst week I was there. I think blood on the floor was a daily occurrence. Attempted murders were weekly. It wasn't a fun place. I'll give you that.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, what's kind of haunting about that story is the fact it was 7 years after you were trading this computer equipment. Mm. It's like, and that's the sort of thing that makes me kind of like, go, okay, what was I doing like 5 years ago? You're like, but that fact it comes back to get you, and it's such a comprehensive fall through the kind of floorboards into this other reality.
Yeah, I came out with nothing, no business, no staff, no credit rating. Yeah, I had a multi-decade 999 credit rating. I had $1 million limit on my Black Amex. And all of that went away to the point where my then fiance, bless her, decided that if I was going to go bankrupt for, you know, hundreds of thousands in legal, I may as well go bankrupt for a bit more, and decided to go shopping in Harrods and pay off her cars and run it through a PayPal. And the irony was, I think I owed more to American Express than I did Hewlett Packard when I came out. As a result of that, I mean, I'm not even ability to have credit or start open a bank. I couldn't open a bank account. I mean, I'd literally started from scratch, and I got excited. When I came out, I mean, we'll get into the story about what happened inside, but when I came out, I'm like, wow, I've never dug myself out of a hole this deep before. This is going to be fun. And that was my default mindset.
It's what's interesting. Obviously, with the part of my story is I'm in a hole. And there's an interesting, my first podcast was with Dan Sullivan, the entrepreneurial coach. Mm-hmm. And he talked about this sort of, you're kind of out there and you've got to sort of dig yourself out of this hole. And there is something thrilling about that. Even when it's really bad, there is something thrilling about it. And what I really admire about what you do and what you did is the embracing the suck, embracing the thing that's like really not very good. And I'm curious, where does that come from, do you think? Where do you think you built that mindset from?
It's about how you view the world. It's about your role in the world. It's about having a level of global beliefs and a psychology that supports stuff like that and not takes you down. You know, we know that every mammal, if it perceives the external situation as a threat, it goes weak. It loses up to 30% of its muscle strength. If it sees or perceives the external event as a challenge, it'll gain muscle strength, focus, and rise to the challenge. And so that's a choice. But it's not a choice that's conscious for most people. It's a choice that's inbred and automatic based upon your beliefs. If you believe you live in a friendly universe, if you believe in yourself, if you believe that you're here for a reason, you have purpose, then you're going to rise. You're going to look for the good. You're going to ask questions like, what's great about this I've not noticed yet? Or you can turn around and if you live in a hostile universe, you're going to think, wow, more evidence that I'm being beaten up, more evidence that, life's out to get me. That's all subjective. Everything is subjective. And your opinion of yourself, your abilities, and your relationship to the world governs everything. And, we're human at the end of the day. We're not meant to be perfect. It's not about that. But if you believe that you're here to grow, as we tend to see evidence to that very supportively, our body is trained to continually be pushed past its physical limits so that it is pre-programmed to return with a better version of itself. Mm. Why do we think that we're designed to live in a comfort zone? We're not. We've been seduced into the modern 20th, 21st century, where we're the first generation, Dan, that's ever had food certainty. Hmm. My parents had rations in the war. Hmm. And as a result of that, we've got an entire generation of people who feel either A, a sense of entitlement, or B, don't know how to handle uncertainty. And that is the entrepreneurial superpower, the ability to handle uncertainty. And when you can come at life from that perspective, that say, hey, listen, at the end of the day, what's it about? If I'm trying to prove to the world I'm good enough by how much money I make, then I'm on a hamster wheel to nowhere, right? Because I'm not going to take it with me. Never seen a hearse with a roof rack. Only people that tried that with the Egyptians. And what happened? We dug it up and stole it, right? So when it comes to if you are tying your self-worth to your net worth, you will always be on the back foot. And because I didn't tie my self-worth to my net worth, when I came out at minus a third of a million in the hole, it didn't impact who I was, how I saw myself, my relationship to life. If I've tied my self-worth to my net worth and all of a sudden I'm in debt, now my self-worth is in the toilet because I've been convinced by society that I'm judged by how much money I have. You're not just how much money you have. That's just projected BS. Mm. Yeah. Total BS belief system that is going to drag you down. Yeah. So from that perspective, you need to make choices. Do you live in a friendly universe or a hostile universe? Pick one, because you can't say I live in a friendly universe while the sun's shining, then I change my mind when the storm clouds come. That doesn't work. If you're trying to control everything to try to make the world fit your pictures, you're going to be banging your head against the wall for a long time. For me, I'm like, one of my favorite sayings, relax, nothing's under control.
Yeah, that giving things, giving up and surrendering is a theme that's come up with multiple conversations on this podcast. This idea of, I know you've talked a lot about this idea of riding on the river. And this is a visualization I've used before. Like, I don't know what's around the bend. I've just got to go with the flow of the river, as it were.
Correct.
And this idea of letting go, of surrendering, of not being in control, of embracing the uncertainty. On this idea of choice, though, I'm just going to, because this is something that I think happens in a microsecond for people, and you've expanded on that in some depth, and you do this throughout your kind of your teachings, I guess, is you're sat there in the holding cell, I guess, just about to go into the kind of out of the Kai Court on your descent to the underworld. You had 30 years of programming with Tony Robbins and others and with yourself to get you to sort of at that sort of switching moment in the brain where you could have gone into, I guess, the freeze moment or the sort of fear moment. You chose to sort of see that in a different way. How do you kind of like work on yourself to be able to do that?
The key point is identity. And one thing I learned from Tony was that He said, the strongest force in the human personality is the need to remain consistent with how you define yourself. For example, our behaviors are always going to be in alignment with our self-image. Hence why if we see ourselves as someone who can't, then we won't. If we see ourselves as a wantrepreneur, somebody who wants to start a business, we're likely not going to succeed because we're always seeing ourselves as somebody who wants to, not somebody who has or somebody who is. So I'm an entrepreneur. If I lose my business tomorrow, it doesn't stop me being an entrepreneur. I don't need a business to validate myself as an entrepreneur. The business will happen as a result of my identity. My identity doesn't get validated by what I've done. That's a big point. Another example, you know, why do runners run? Right? Because they're runners. They've got the same two arms, legs, and biochemistry as you and I have. But you know, if they don't run for a week, they get angsty. Whereas somebody sitting with the same biochemistry on the couch watching Netflix with Haagen-Dazs isn't going to get angsty if they haven't ran a 10K that day, right? Mm. So our identity governs everything. Vegetarians don't eat meat, not because they have different teeth or a different digestive system, because their identity is, I am a vegetarian. Now, the reasons we choose identities are varied. If it's empowering, it's because we choose it. For example, I want to choose to be a vegetarian because of moral issues or taste issues or health issues or whatever it may be for somebody. But once I have that identity, it governs what I order off the menu. Where it comes to a very disempowering side is when we take on identities that other people give us. You're not good enough. You'll never amount to anything. You start a business. Yeah, you couldn't start a race. Yeah, whatever it may be, we hear other people's negativity and criticism, whether it's people of influence, parents, teachers, yeah, ministers, yeah, or whatever it may be. And when we adopt that and we take those labels on, unfortunately, most people take them on with the appearance of superglue. It becomes who they are. We don't realize that every label is Velcro. You get the chance to take that off. You get the chance to question that. You get the chance to design your own damn label. And so my identity walking down those steps in court into the holding cell was a critical point. It was like a real sort of crossing the Rubicon. What was the choice I had? I could choose what 99% of people walking down that stairs would choose, which is the identity of a prisoner. That is a tunnel with no cheese, right? That's going to be a place where I don't want to go because I know where that has victim mentality, resentment, hopelessness, despair, all of those emotions associated with somebody who's been forced into incarceration against a result they didn't want. Mm-hmm. Or I could ask a better question. What's a more empowering identity? I'm like, look what I've been doing for the last 25 years, helping people, being able to inspire them, being able to give them tools and techniques for managing their inner world. Why? Because outer world follows inner world. Case closed. And so if you're trying to control your outer world with desperation and hope and insecurity or frustration, it's like getting angry at the mirror because it's not smiling. Mm. It's never going to work. So the identity that I chose walking down those steps, I thought, wow, I've spent 25 years preparing for this. I'm going in as a secret agent of change. Hmm. I'm an undercover Jedi. Right? And my role here is crystal clear. The people that I could probably help in society the most are the very ones who would never get access to YouTube or be inspired to go to an event or something like that, but are probably in the depths of somewhere like Pentonville. Wow, what an opportunity. If I've got to go shine a light, give me the darkest room I can shine it in, because that's why I'm here. And that's how I went in. I went in as I never saw myself as a prisoner, not for a second. It's funny, when things started unfolding and I started really getting a bit of a name within a week or two of being able to be somebody who's helping people. And long story short, I got a lot of prisoners off drugs. I was stopping suicides. I won a national award for while I was in there for reducing violence between the wings with some of the work that I did. And the legacy is amazing. I mean, we're impacting tens of thousands of prisoners a month right now, 4 years later, in prisons all over the world in multiple languages with the work that I did. But I'd walk down the wing and the officers would often ask, "Oh, Mr. Sage, how are we doing today?" Because they'd know the answer. And I'd be like, living the dream. and they would laugh and everyone would laugh and people would smile. And I'd whistle two tunes as I was going around doing what I did. And this is bang up. I'm only out of the cell for 45 minutes a day. All right. Maybe twice that long if we get exercise. But this was January and it rains in England and the guards don't like getting wet. So exercise was most often canceled. So when I'm out, I'd whistle. And the two tunes I would whistle, one was The Great Escape. Right. And when people would cotton on, they'd start smiling. And the other was Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, Monty Python.
Brilliant.
And just to try to bring some sort of normality, And one of the biggest things, and this is something great for entrepreneurs as well, that one of the biggest differences, one of the first differences I was able to make to prisoners was to get them to a place of acceptance as opposed to resistance. Now, acceptance should not be confused for resignation. That's reluctant acceptance. But if you're getting upset over something that has already happened, you're futile. Yeah, it's a fool's errand. Why? If the milk is spilt on the carpet, bitching about it's not going to put it back in the bottle. Right? What's happened has happened. It is what it is. Now, how do we free up the energy of frustration, resistance, resentment, anger, and all the rest of it, and channel that energy into what is the next best move to be able to make? Yeah, if you've had a client that's just been poached by your competitor, or your number one sales guy has just took all your clients and ran away somewhere, okay, getting angry about it and bitching to your wife that night over dinner and being this idiot she's lying next to at night or whatever, is not going to help the situation. Worrying about something that's already happened is futile, right? So if you can come to terms of, okay, this has happened, what is the next best move for me to make and channel that energy into there? Then you can either start a lawsuit against your former employee, or you can contact your existing clients and let them know what's happened, or you can, come to terms with the fact that, okay, I'm going to appeal my sentence that the judge gave me, or what can I learn from this that next time, wouldn't land me back in prison, or whatever it may be. So coming back to your point about surrender, there is a distinction here that's useful.
Mm.
People can only hear from the level they are at. Yeah, you don't expect a three-year-old to have a conversation about social economics. So emotional maturity is a big issue. So if you are calibrating at a level of anger, fear, shame, guilt, whatever, you're not going to hear surrender from an empowering perspective.
Mm.
So if you're calibrating at fear, surrender is to acquiesce.
Mm.
It's to give up. Then you're down into apathy, not hope. And if you're in pride, try telling a Royal Marine to surrender. See what happens. Right? They're not going to hear it. You have to calibrate over the point of courage to be open enough to let your ego get out of the way, to experience some level of humility, so that then when you hear the word surrender, you're hearing it from a different place. You're hearing it from surrender to the wisdom of the current of the river. Surrender to something greater than you. Surrender to the fact that you live in a friendly universe and it's got your back, even if your left brain doesn't think it fits the pictures of what that should look like right now. That's a different form of surrender. That's letting go of the need for control, not necessarily letting go of control. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah, very much. And this is something I've wrestled with. The need, like you say, the left brain trying to pin everything down. I've got a model and this model is repeatable and will work forever. That's my ego trying to control everything. And you just letting go of some of that, creating some almost fluidity in your movement, like in the world. So it's not quite as jagged or not quite as tense. So a bit like a kind of dance. You're dancing with the world, the universe, the ideas, the people, rather than trying to force or bulldozer your ideas through.
I'll give you two easy metaphors for the listeners to probably relate to. One is a martial arts metaphor. So if you take karate is about forceful kicks, punches, blocks, breaks, that kind of stuff. That's how most people try to take on their problems. Aikido is different. Aikido uses the momentum of your opponent against them. There's no kicks, punches, or blocks, or breaks. You're actually, the stronger your opponent, the better your position. When it comes to that, the more forceful your opponent strikes, the more you use that force against them. Now, when it comes to sailing in the river of life, most people in the karate mode are like, okay, I'm heading south and my goals are south and I'm all on track and everything's looking good. And all of a sudden the river bends east. Oh, this isn't according to my picture. So what do? They don't go with the river. They take a shovel off their back, moor up at the bank and start digging a channel through the bank south. Yeah, it's like it's so much energy wasted as opposed to letting go or going with the current, which will usually catapult you back around far faster to the direction you want. So to sum it up, I would say this to people. Rather than use your energy to fight the current of the river of life, that's futile. The river's going to win over time. Instead, use your energy to better position yourself in the current. That's a far better use of energy. And therefore, you're starting to turn your problems instead of into a battle, you start turning it into that dance of that mental Aikido where you, over time, will always come out. You don't have to believe this. You just look at your history. Now, how many times have we had something? You're a great case in point here, myself as well, with the, you know, blowing up the business. Where you, at the time, it looks catastrophic. At worst, maybe massively inconvenient at best, and that could be a traumatic divorce, or it could be a loss of a goal or a loved one or some health issue, only to look back on it 6 months later and thinking, wow, thank goodness that happened, otherwise I wouldn't be doing this now. We've all had experiences of that. So my question is, if we know that historically, and that seems to be a pattern, next, if something happens once, it's an incident, happens twice, it's a coincidence. If it happens more than twice, it's a pattern, and patterns are governed by laws. Yeah, so if it happens consistently, which it does almost all of the time, because you can pick more than two examples in your life where that's happened, my question is, why wait 6 months before you get excited?
Yeah, you've used this phrase, the gift of adversity. Mm-hmm. And to this point, why get excited about a gift 6 months after you've been given it?
I see that most problems are gifts in adversity. They're gifts that have been wrapped in wrapping paper, a thin layer of adversity to disguise them so other people don't steal your gift. And most people bitch at the wrapping paper. I mean, if you had a diamond, if you had a diamond but was wrapped in biohazard wrapping paper and you never opened it because you were scared of the paper, then you're never going to get the diamond. And if the way I see it is, if you're walking down the path of life and all of a sudden you have a problem, you've got a shovel on your back. If you can take that shovel and start digging for gold, what's beneath this? What's under the surface here? What lessons can I learn? What's exciting about this that could potentially show up in the future? What is it I'm here to get as a message that can empower me, not disempower me? And the deeper you dig under those emotions of fear, frustration, resentment, anger, distraction, whatever, the closer you're going to get to the gold. The challenge is in most of society, because people have been conditioned into a comfort zone-centric life rather than a growth-centric life, they don't reach for a shovel. They reach for a drink. They reach for a distraction. They reach for an excuse. They reach for an escape. And therefore, they never get the lesson. And therefore, the lesson will repeat itself downstream, because that's why we're here. We're in Earth school to learn and grow, not to try to barricade ourselves into a classroom of comfort.
That is gold, what you just said, by the way. The fact that you people will use that distraction, be it, you mentioned Netflix earlier, Twitter, other stuff, booze, to sort of ease this pain of this wrapper around the golden lesson. Interestingly, we're just coming out of a period where we've all been in a form of prison, a lockdown that's been imposed on us. You talk about in the book, sort of focusing on the facts, not the story around it, to reframe a bad situation. You ask yourself some questions, just to sort of frame yourself to help you get to the gold. I wonder if we could get into that, because I think coming out of lockdown, a lot of people see this as a bad thing they need to put behind them rather than something to dig into to get the gold. How would you advise entrepreneurs who've had a rough year or a rough couple of years because of the lockdown, the pandemic, building on the experiences you've had?
I got asked this question a lot during the middle of lockdown. And I gave several examples. I'll share one here. So, I don't have my parents anymore. They're both gone. And I had a very strong relationship with them, which I was fortunate. We went through some interventions and things transpired. So it was hard to let go, because they were my last living relatives that were close. I've got some aunts, uncles, cousins somewhere, but it's rare that I connect. No brothers, no sisters, or grandparents. And I remember that one of the biggest challenges with most entrepreneurs is that they are chasing the rainbow. They're trying to get to the end of the rainbow. And the joke is that they sacrifice the best years of their life, sacrifice their health, their relationship, watching their kids grow up so that they can justify working silly hours a week to hopefully get enough money to retire or exit or have a lifestyle where they can finally enjoy their life. But the reality is most people work so hard during that period. And the lucky ones, if they do make it to a point where they feel they've got what it is that they deserve, and they finally use that money for what? to pay for their divorce, to hire a personal trainer to get their health back, and to buy their kids loads of crap so they love them again. I mean, it's almost a joke. And the amount of people I've known that have got to Success Mountain and want to at the top and want to jump off because it's not what they thought they wanted. And I'm like, if you were able to go back and spend that time with your kids, if you were able to appreciate the fact that, oh, why do we go on holiday every, twice a year, three times a year, whatever it is, if we can, to get away from the stuff. Yeah, to read about. And I was speaking to people in lockdown, they're like, wow, yeah, I'm reading these books that I've had on my shelf for so long. I'm connected with my kids in a way that I didn't even know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, guys, you may only get, this is at the time where we thought it was going to be 2 weeks to flatten the curve, if you remember that BS.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, it's like, you may only get one lockdown. Right? It says, savor it, right? Don't resist it. Yeah, if you are trying to get frustrated over things you can't control, you're a fool. I've always said the fastest way to Stressville is to try to get somebody else to be, do, act, or behave in a way where you want them to be, do, act, or behave. It's never going to happen. And so when it comes to the frustration, look over time. Over the first 5,000 years and the next 5,000 years are going to be pretty the same when it comes to what, what's in the crystal ball. I know what's going to happen. And you know what's funny? In beginning of January 2020, someone asked me, and it's on a live, I go, what's 2020 going to tell us? I says, I know exactly what 2020 is going to hold. And I was right. I was absolutely right. Now, nobody at the beginning of 2020 knew there was anything called a pandemic. Yeah, let's not get into the belief system around that. Okay? But they said, why? How do you know what's going to happen this year? I says, because I know what's happened last year in the last 5,000 years. What's going to happen for the next 5,000 years? Challenge and opportunity. Hmm. Challenge and opportunity. And some people are going to see this as, oh my God, my business is failing. I'm in a sector that's been, the travel sector has been destroyed. The hospitality sector has been destroyed. The leisure industry has been destroyed, blah, 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 blah. And I learned to pivot. There are people right now that are crushing it. I had my best business year in 2020 ever in 30 years until the first quarter of 2021 when I surpassed it. Hmm. That's not because I'm smart. Or I had to pivot. We all had to pivot. But entrepreneurs are able to dance. Then the people who unfortunately are still relying on somebody else to control their income, or the people that aren't so much entrepreneurs, and this isn't, it may be a challenge to somebody's identity right now, but I'll lay it out because I think it's valuable. A lot of entrepreneurs aren't entrepreneurs. They're technicians that are engaging in entrepreneurial activity. And if you're a hairdresser and you start your own salon, you're a technician playing the entrepreneur game. See, if you are a mechanic who's a good mechanic and start their own garage, you're a technician playing the entrepreneur game. See, entrepreneurs don't have a trade. Our trade is to adapt to circumstances to enable us to capitalize on ideas that can be profitable by adding value to society or the public by product or service. So the very nature, and I talk about this in chapter 4, the very nature of the prime directive of entrepreneurs is to find a way to adapt to challenges, to competition, to changing circumstances, to the economy. All of that is going to change. None of that we can control. The only thing we can control is our ability to dance on the chessboard and play the game as best we can. And yeah, you're going to get slapped. Yes, whether that's a freezing order by Hewlett-Packard suing you for $17 million, or whether that's the government saying, I'm sorry, but you can't operate as a restaurant anymore, or a gym, or any of this other BS. I started a chain of health clubs back in 2002, a national chain called Energy Health and Fitness, about 120 clubs now. I sold out to my co-founder, Jan Spatiki, an amazing guy. And Jan sold out Energy for multi-millions in October 19. Great timing.
Wow.
To a private venture firm. And yeah, I was so happy for him. He'd worked so hard since I passed the business to him, and he'd just worked his tail off, cashed out, million in the bank. And he, of course, what happened then was everything went into lockdown. All of the clubs got shut. The private equity firm suffered massive losses, and Jan went back in August or September last year, and bought it back at like 15 cents on the dollar.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And then pivoted the entire club into digital fitness.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it was going to be a unicorn. He was so excited. It was going to be the first billion-dollar company he was going to build. He'd also then bought into British Military Fitness and became chairman. And I had a great conversation with Jan about 2.5 months ago, and he was ecstatic. It was exciting. He was giving me a tour of his multi-million-dollar home he'd bought, and we tease each other over the supercars. We always had good cars back in the day. I had my Ferrari, he had his XJ R, and I had my McLaren in Dubai, and he really wanted a McLaren. He went and bought a McLaren when he cashed out, and of course I got nothing, so I'm just bouncing back from Pentonville. I've just been and bought my other McLaren now, but we were having a really good time. 3 weeks later, he was dead.
Whoa.
2 months ago. Yeah. Went into hospital with a pain in his hip. Did a scan, terminal cancer. 2 weeks later, he was dead. He'd gone. He'd worked the last 15 years solid since we parted ways and I sold out my share to energy and to him to build it, to finally get to the top of Success Mountain. You know what I'm saying about trying to get your health back? And it was a massive wake up or reminder again for me. But it was testament to the fact that all through COVID, all through the lockdown, all he was thinking about is how can I turn this to my advantage? He was the consummate entrepreneur, one of the most incredible executive entrepreneurs I'd ever met and had the privilege of working with and being a partner with. And a real loss and a real shame that he's gone to film his next movie, wherever that may be. But none of us that are bitching about stuff right now, when faced with something like our own mortality, it starts to shift the perspective and the context of how much meaning we tend to give stuff, which my experience is we tend to over-dramatize and give way too much importance to things that really aren't that important. So yeah, oh, my business is going down because, listen, you've got a business. You've got the ability to build a business. You've already demonstrated. You've got the ability to handle uncertainty more than almost anyone you're at school with in the same class that's probably working for somebody else right now or on furlough, right? You've got the opportunity to demonstrate to your employees, your family, to be a beacon of certainty in a time of uncertainty. You've got the ability to be able to say, listen, I don't know, I'll be honest, how we're going to get through this, but we will, because I'm committed to doing this. And at some point, we're going to look back on this and laugh, and it'll be stories for the grandkids. That's the attitude to be able to take when it comes to looking at this right now.
Yeah, that being a beacon of certainty in an uncertain world, the belief that you will find a way. That's something I can really relate to. It's because oftentimes, particularly in my turmoil, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I had a team of people who were looking to me for I guess, confidence. So I had to say, and this is, by the way, has been the same thing all the way through the pandemic, because we've had to pivot and we've changed a lot. And as it's happened, it's been the best thing in probably, we've been going for 17 years. We had a rough time, pivoted in 2017, and it was better for the business. There was a gift wrapped in that toxic wrapping paper. When the pandemic hit, I was like, oh my God, I'm back to 2017 again. Turns out, it was another gift. And it sharpened our thinking and got us to orient on what was important. My point here is the belief. I thought, I'm going to commit 100%. I'm going to burn the boats. I know you like the Think and Grow Rich book, and he tells this story about burning the boats. So you can't retreat and just commit. And there's a certain energy that comes from that, that brings people with you and helps you kind of get through these sort of uncertain times.
100%. And again, when it comes to the belief, you need to let go of the how. It's the how that'll send you into a tailspin. The how's none of your damn business. When you have certainty, the how will present itself. The goal, I say to people, the two organizing principles I have on setting goals. The first is, if I have any idea how I can achieve the goal when I set it, it's too small. Right, where's the space for magic to show? Where's the space for life to step in? Where's the space for wonder and imagination and creativity to come through? If I know how to achieve the goal, it's too small. It's too boring. And most people don't achieve goals because the goals are too boring. Fact. Now, the second organizing principle is this. The purpose of setting a goal is not to achieve the goal. It is, if you're coming from scarcity, to try to prove to the world that you're good enough so you can get the acceptance, approval, validation that you think you need from people that really can't be bothered to give it because they're too busy trying to get their own. But the purpose of setting a goal is to see who do you need to become in order to achieve it. Now, when you see it from that angle, it's not about finishing the marathon de Saab, if I'd have got to the last day and been taken out of the race, who did I need to become in order to get to the last day of the MDS? That's what I want to be celebrating. Not the fact I missed the medal. Yeah, I didn't. But yeah, if I did, that's, you know, that would have been the focus. Okay? It's not about getting to the top of Everest. It's about, you know, who do you have to become in order to, you know, take the journey?
Yeah. And I think that's just, as you were talking about the goal and not knowing the how, that was my relationship with the Marathon de Saab. Somebody suggested it to me on a 10K run that we do with some mates once a week. I think that's a joke. Like, hey, Dan, we're thinking about doing this. Do you want to do this? And I was like, when he said, I was like, no, I'm not doing that. It's ridiculous. How could I do that? But then it sort of was like a little flea in my ear. I was like, I could say yes, right? And the thing that got me over the line to say yes wasn't, I didn't know how I could do it. I didn't know if, I still don't know if I can do it. I wasn't a runner, quotes unquote, before signing up for this. I thought, this is like an immovable object. I'm going to have to get really fit, really get my kind of mindset in the game, get my nutrition good. And I'm 49 next year. And so I'll be entering my 50th year having that on my belt. So a sense of like, okay, I've now can do this thing. So I didn't know how I was going to do it. And then almost immediately after I started to say I'm going to do it, people came out of the woodwork, helped put plans together to just out of nowhere. And I've got like a team of people helping me for free because I they were reciprocating things I'd given to them. And because I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it. And so the road almost appeared before me after I made that commitment, that kind of actual emotional commitment.
Yep, that's the way it works. And we call that positive confirmation. And most people are surrounded by positive confirmation, but they don't collect it. And when you start writing it down, I tell people, if you keep there's certain journals that are very useful to keep. One is a magic moments journal. Yeah, capture your magic moments. I've got over 1,000. I had over 200 in prison.
Hmm.
Yeah. Gratitude journal is key. Yeah, that's especially at night. Write down things you go. To go to bed grateful rather than frustrated will transform your sleep, your recovery, your mindset. You'll wake up fresh, optimistic, rather than scared, paranoid, pessimistic, reaching for your phone to try to get certainty that, you know, some of the crap. So, but the most powerful journal people can keep is a journal of positive confirmation. And that is because sometimes when you're going to face uncertainty, which is part of the design, it's part of the rule set, you're going to be challenged. Now, if you think you can lift 10 kilos, what's the personal trainer's job? Give you 12. When you can lift 12, what's the personal trainer's job? Give you 15. That's the nature of why we're here. We're here to grow. Grow and contribute. Everything in nature grows and contributes, or it's taken out of the food chain. Right? We just think we're different because we've been seduced into a comfort-centric existence that doesn't exist. So if we can understand that, you know, we will be tested. And at that point, that congruency, if we capture it, when we let go of the need for control, when we let go of the how and it shows up and we capture that in our journal, the next time there's a lot of weight on the bar and you're looking and thinking, whoa, I don't know what the hell's going to happen here. But, oh, here's the last 27 times that I didn't know and something good showed up. It allows the left brain to pipe down. It allows it to, the cortisol to balance. And it allows you to start getting inspired and hopeful in something that you don't have evidence of yet. And that is a powerful place to live.
I agree. I think that's really getting this stuff down, because it just tends to evaporate in one's mind. And particularly in the rough and tumble, when there's a scary moment happens or a large change drops on your desk, whatever that might be. On this subject of gratitude, though, because again, I was really interested, you were in the prison and you were showing gratitude. And there was an exercise where you said, what are the things I can be grateful for? And I just thought it's so counterintuitive, I think, for most people listening, or most people. How can you be showing gratitude when you've been railroaded into this situation by all these things have happened to you? So can you just speak on that subject? I think it's very powerful.
There's always, always, always something to be grateful for. And again, it's a choice of focus. Questions are the steering wheel of the mind. Yeah, questions direct focus. Focus is everything. Yeah, the only thing you have is your awareness, by the way. People haven't figured that out yet. You know, the only thing that you can do in life is experience. If you want to take it one step further, the only thing you can actually experience is the act of experiencing. But, you know, we build story around everything else. But, you know, how you are in the moment is everything. And if you ask the questions, why me? And you go down a victim mentality and or narratives that try to change the past. If only this, if only that, if, you know, blah, blah, blah. What if this? It's, yeah, ask better questions. And one of the questions, what could I be grateful for right now? And then with the prisoners, one of the guys I was banged up with, Mark, who was a big guy, violent guy. And I was with him for 10 days. And that was not without its issues. And yeah, he was all moaning. He'd got, you know, 10 months for this assault and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, what's the maximum sentence? He's gone, well, yeah, the maximum sentence was 3 years. I go, okay, let's say you got half that, 18 months down the middle. All right. And the judge, yeah, your solicitor, barrister, whatever, went to the judge, you know, a few days later, says, listen, it was pretty harsh. Can we cut him some slack? And they said, you know something? I'll cut it 18 months to 10 months. And he came and gave you that information yesterday. How would you be feeling right now? You only got 10 months rather than the 18. What you're saying now is, oh, I got 10 instead of 6. Right? You're contrasting it the wrong way. There's always a way to be grateful. And again, when I was lying on the prison bed, and this is January in England, there's very little heating. There's two pipes that go through the cell that carry the hot water when it's hot, but it's freezing cold. And you don't get a blanket. You get what's more like a tablecloth. Hmm. And that, so I'm shivering on the bunk at night. And I thought, okay, what's the contrast frame here? And I thought of the Marathon Day Saab. I thought, well, I remember shivering a lot worse in the desert because at night it's freezing cold. Yeah, and you could feel the camel spiders and the scorpions crawling over your sleeping bag. You know, I'm making it more appealing for you right now.
Thank you.
And the tents were like open-sided. So if a sandstorm came, you got a mouthful of sand at night. And I'm like, wow, what would I have given for a nice, cozy, comfy prison bed? Yeah, while lying under the stars in the Marathon Day Saab, yeah, with my body aching and my feet bleeding and God knows what. Yeah, I'd have given anything for this nice warm, yeah, warmish or warmer, yeah, less freezing bed in Bentonville. Yeah. Yeah. What could I be grateful for right now? I'm grateful for that I'm in a position where, you know, I'm not in Auschwitz. Yeah, and I would send people copies. I would have copies of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl sent in. And I'd challenge prisoners, read this and don't cry. You know, I challenge you not to cry with gratitude that you're in Pentonville, not Auschwitz. Yeah, there was a time where I smashed up my face. I did 4.5 hours of plastic surgery to rebuild my face after a skiing accident. And I remember lying there when they came in and told me and suddenly bursting into tears. And my girlfriend at the time, Tammy, she was there and she was like, yeah, are you okay, honey? I'm like, I'm happy. And I was crying tears of gratitude. She goes, what? I said, yeah, do you know how much force it takes to snap, to break an orbit? Yeah. And in the skull, a lot of force, a lot more force than it takes to break a neck. If I'd have landed just a couple of, like a quarter of an inch at a different angle, and I'd be a quadriplegic right now. Imagine if that would have happened and I'm lying here, not been able to move for the rest of my life, having to be spoon fed and dressed. Yeah. And fairy godmother comes down. Let's call him Clarence from Wonderful Life, you know, and says, hey, Pete, cool, tough day today at the office, buddy. You know, didn't see that coming. But look, me and the rest of the fairies out here, we think you're a good bloke. We're going to give you a one-shot deal. We're going to give you one-time offer. We're going to rewind. We're just going to move your face a little bit to the left. And instead of snapping your neck, and being a quadriplegic, we're just going to bust up your cheek, which will heal in the next few weeks. Do you want to take the deal? Like, snap the hand off and say thank you and cry for the rest of the day with how lucky you are. There's always something to be grateful for.
Very powerful. Yeah, I think this is something that particularly in the moment, the current moment, the lockdown moment, there's a lot of people focused on negativity. And I think... particularly, I know you have an opinion about the mass media and how consuming that kind of content. So I'll summarize it. Don't engage with it. I think it's a good strategy.
If you think the news is giving you the news, then you're in Disneyland. Sorry, just stop being programmed and start taking charge of your programming. Case closed. I've got videos that'll explain the psychology, the neuroscience, and the business model behind why they do what they do, which I've been talking about for years. Go watch it. It's on my YouTube channel. You know, just Google Peter Sage Media. But on YouTube. But yeah, no, it's yeah. As human beings, we don't get to choose whether or not we're programmed. We only get to choose how. Mm. And if we take charge of the nature of the input, just like our food, we can choose what to eat, or we can be fed by other people whose choice of diet doesn't have our best health interests at heart. Or we can choose to feed ourselves. Now, we do that physically, but the diet you want to be most concerned with is not the food you're eating, it's the thoughts you're thinking.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this whole being conscious of that, aware of that, understanding how you're being programmed or could be programmed, being sort of taking your choices on that and not allowing yourself to get drawn into a spiral of negativity and keep that gratitude focus, looking for the opportunities. There's so much good stuff in here. And you mentioned very briefly there, but where should people go if they want to find out more of your great stuff? Where's the best place to find you?
Always go to my website, petersage.com. You can follow me on Instagram, petersage007. If you want to go to YouTube, I'm same there, petersage007. I'm easy to find. And again, I put out a ton of stuff to try to help people right now. I created the self-mastery program as the most affordable way for people during lockdown or COVID or having financial hardships to get the best of my work on a structured program to be able to master themselves and think like this automatically for like the cheapest in the industry. I think I charge like $49 a month or $350 for the year, something like that, US. As opposed to some of my higher level programs, obviously tens of thousands of dollars. But I want to be able to help people. But even if people are struggling right now, I put a ton of stuff out on YouTube for free that's super valuable. And that's all I want to do. And I'm giving the book away as well. People can go to getpetesbook.com if you don't mind mentioning that. I'm giving it away for the cost of shipping. On there, just go and have a look. It's the 11 letters, as you know, that I wrote from inside prison to my senior coaching students, teaching them how I was doing what I was doing. How was I stopping suicides? How was I preventing myself from getting depressed? How was I being able to turn people around that were so upset into people who were joyous to walk down the prison whistling with me? That doesn't happen because I'm smart. It just happens after 30 years of being able to study what I study, and I condense the best of that into those letters to my students. And the inside track, the book, is simply the 11 letters that I wrote unedited from where it was. So it's raw, it's real, it's part journal, it's part how-to manual, it's part you couldn't make it up, but it's real. And it's the best work that I've done in writing to help people. And what's so interesting is the tagline of the book is the ultimate guide to conquering adversity. This was written, obviously, 3 years before the so-called pandemic. And so right now it's a tool set and a skill set that allows the mindset for people to be shifted that's so pertinent to today's world. Because as I said, there are people that are getting crushed right now because they don't know how to handle the inner game. And there are people that are crushing it because they do. Same industry, same government regulations, same everything else, all being equal. Different mindset, different result.
That's so great. The book is The Inside Track. Peter Sage, get him online. I'm going to finish with a quote from Viktor Frankl. You mentioned Man's Search for Meaning, and I again very much took inspiration from that book. But Viktor Frankl said that who was in Auschwitz, by the way, lost all his family and was a psychotherapist and his theory was logotherapy, or searching for meaning to give you meaning in life to get you through the dark times. And just on this particular point, he said that forces beyond your control can take away everything you possess, except one thing, your freedom to choose how you will respond to the situation. And for me, I find that really powerful to orient me. Lockdowns, prisons, business bankruptcies, all this stuff that comes at you as an entrepreneur, you have the choice to how you respond. And I think what Peter's been able to do today, and so thank you, Peter, is to give us some insight into how he did that in the most trying of times. So really check out the book, check out him out on across the internet. And I just got to say thank you on behalf of all of our sort of listeners and for me for coming. It's been a real honor.
No, the pleasure's been mine. Thank you, Dan, for providing this opportunity. It's rare that you see somebody that is able to share the insights into their own personal adversity. Everyone's talking up the 10x this and the double that, and you're running on the track of achievement to trying to find fulfillment, which will never work. But it's very rare that you get somebody who's like humble enough to come say, hey, listen, I lost everything. Here's how it tanked. Here's what I learned from it. Here's how I can help you with some of the advice and lessons that I've got. And to capitalize on your quote from Viktor Frankl, the easiest way I sum it up is that to remember, A, nobody but nobody has the right to tell you can't do it. But more importantly, nobody can ever do anything to you emotionally without your permission.
Great. I think that's a beautiful place to wrap up our podcast today. I really think that's this is one for people to listen to a couple of times because it's so much packed full of good stuff in there. Well, I'm just going to sign off and say thank you, Peter, for coming. I'm going to get back on your audio books and YouTube channels and keep learning from you. And I'll see everybody next time. Great to have you here.
Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google, Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening and I'll see you next time.